Good morning, everyone. Can we all find a seat, please? We'd like to get started.
You have a gavel?
I'm not using the gavel.
Will we use my cane?
No. Good morning. Welcome, everybody. We're about to get started. Please find a seat. Thank you. I will now call this regular meeting and special meeting of the San Diego Housing Commission Board of Commissioners to order. It is 9:03. To accommodate a potentially large number of people that are attending today, two other rooms in the building have been identified to provide overflow seating, the lunchroom just down the hall, and then the conference room on the first floor in the SDHC Achievement Academy. We're also live streaming video of this meeting to both of these rooms. Members of the public in these rooms will have the opportunity to listen and to view this meeting and to provide public comments if they wish to do so. This is the same procedure used by the City Council when there is not sufficient space in council chambers and overflow is accommodated within committee rooms. The public listens to the matter until it is time for them to testify, at which time they move to council chambers to testify. Speaker slips are available here in the boardroom and in both of our overflow rooms. Thank you. Housing Commission staff will collect speaker slips from each location and bring them to our recording secretary here in the boardroom. There are three types of speaker slips. If you wish to address the Housing Commission on an item that is not on the agenda this morning, please fill out the white form. Non-agenda public comment will be called first, so if you wish to speak, please complete that slip and turn it in now. Those who fill out the white form for non-agenda public comment will be allowed to speak for 3 minutes, and if you wish to speak on a specific agenda item, please fill out a yellow or a pink form. If you're speaking in opposition, please fill out the pink form, and those in favor would support or would fill out the yellow form. If we have a large number of people who wish to speak on an agenda item, speakers on that item may be limited to one speaker, so please, or 1 minute per speaker, so please plan accordingly. If you wish to cede your minute to another speaker, please write that on the speaker slip and identify the speaker to whom you are ceding your time. I will call 5 names at a time. When you hear your name, please line up behind the podium and wait for your turn to speak. Staff will help to escort those in the overflow rooms to the boardroom when their names are called. After you have made your comments, you'll be able to return to your seating area and view the remainder of the meeting. Public testimony will be taken after staff makes their presentation to the agenda item. And now we will proceed with the non-agenda public comments, of which it looks like we have none. Okay. Do we have any commissioner comments to start our meeting? Okay. I will briefly say that I was able to stop by the Homeless Connect event and in Golden Hall, and it was fantastic. I was so blown away by the immense amount of work that staff and the city put in, and just the breadth of service that was provided, the expertise from the service providers that were there and their wonderful attitudes. I was there like 4 hours in, and they were still smiling, still helping a number of people, and I was very impressed. You shall be very proud of the work that you did. Thank you. Anything else from anyone? Okay, a report by the president and CEO.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have about a half a dozen very brief items this morning to share with the board and the public. And these are all positive news items that I think is worthy of notation. First, as you all saw from a press release that we sent out, I believe it was yesterday, Housing First San Diego, a 3.0 plan that we put on the street July the 1st, 2017, we set out a 3-year goal of getting an additional 3,000 folks off the streets in the following 3 years. Well, we made that mark this month in just over 6 months. And just over 18 months, I'm sorry, a year and 6 months. And the initial phase of Housing First San Diego, as those of you who are around then remember, was back on November the 12th, 2014. We set out a goal then of getting 1,500 people off the street in the following 3 years. We made 3,000, just short of 3,000. And this year we targeted 3,000 in 3 years. We made it in just over 18 months. That means about 6,000 San Diegans, homeless, formerly homeless San Diegans, or who were at risk of homelessness, that have been housed over the last 4.5 years. I think that's a remarkable achievement. It reflects, I see Keely Halsey here, reflects some great cooperation with the city, both the mayor's office and the city council, sitting as housing authority. And it reflects some wonderful work done by staff here, led by, Lisa Jones, who heads up our housing, homeless innovations team. And of course, Jeff Davis, our deputy CEO, chief of staff. So what I'll point out is that this is, although if you look at the streets, it's not always apparent because of the ever-increasing number of homeless. You can imagine what the situation would be had we not gotten these 6,000 folks off the streets over the past 4.5 years. I think it's a remarkable achievement. It reflects excellent work by the staff, and it also reflects great work by this board. When the last time the board put together a strategic plan back in 2014, homelessness was one of the top priorities enunciated by this board for us to address. And even though the board has changed over the years considerably, the direction is held firm. And it's a great reflection, I think, of setting policy by the respective boards here and also execution by staff. And if you want more about that, we'd be glad to fill you in the details on exactly which program served how many people, but I think this is a remarkable achievement. Related but different, as Chair Benvenuto pointed out, the 13th annual Project Homeless Connect was held on January the 30th of this year. The Housing Commissioner has been the lead organizer for this one-day resources fair for 9 years in a row. This year we served some 905 homeless San Diegans. This number peaked about 3 years ago and has been marginally coming down since then, but the 905 was the number that we served this year. Chairman Benvenuto was at the event, as were the honorary co-chairs of Council President Georgette Gomez and Council Member Chris Ward. In addition, Mayor Faulkner, Council President Pro Tem Barbara Bree, and council members Jennifer Campbell and Monica Montgomery also came by the event. This year brought together more than 100 service provider booths and approximately 140 volunteers under one roof at Golden Hall. And as I said, it served some 905 homeless San Diegans. Major organizing partners with the Commission for Project Homeless Connect were the City of San Diego, the Interfaith Shelter Network, Family Health Centers of San Diego, and Father Joe's Villages. Also homeless-related, the We Count All point-in-time count occurred on January the 25th, and on this Friday, this was the Friday before Project Homeless Connect occurred the following week. And this is San Diego's point-in-time count census of the homeless required by the federal government. Among the hundreds of volunteers who participated this year were California State's Senate President Pro Tem Tony Atkins, California State Assembly Member Todd Gloria, San Diego County Supervisor Greg Cox and Nathan Fletcher, San Diego City Council Members Mark Kersey and Chris Ward, Chair Benvenuto, Vice Chair Ryan Klumpner, and former Housing Commission Chair Gary Grambling. Great to see so many folks come out for this event, include a number of staff as well as members of the board. One other event that occurred since the last board meeting that I want to draw the board's attention to, on January the 17th, the new California Treasurer, Fiona Ma, stopped by and visited with us as part of her listening tour of California. She had a number of stops in California, and her stop here in San Diego was with us. And I joined Treasurer Ma and her Deputy Treasurer of Housing and Economic Development, Jovan Aji, in a discussion where we had more than 60 members of the community in here, including developers, nonprofit partners, and supporters of creating more affordable housing. I also provided Treasurer Ma with a number of copies of reports from the past that this agency has produced, including addressing the housing affordability crisis, the action plan that we created back in 2016, addressing the homeless affordability crisis, the housing production objectives, which we produced in 2017, and our fiscal year 2018 annual report. Treasurer Ma's office oversees the allocation systems for both exits and bonds and low-income housing tax credits, which are pretty critical to producing new housing, not only here but throughout the state. And having Treasurer Ma here was a nice reflection, I think, on us and our ability to host her. Finally, Chairperson Benvenuto, I'd like to close with some other good news, some numbers that I think are significant. The Housing Commission did a landlord survey in December of 2018. Of those landlords who are partners with us in our Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Rental Assistance Program. Some 313 landlords responded to our survey, and more than 82% said that the Housing Commission's overall customer service was good, very good, or excellent. And the number of landlords who responded very good or excellent increased by 10% over 2015 when we did the last survey. More than three-quarters of the landlords responding said that the Housing Commission staff were very knowledgeable or extremely knowledgeable. That's up about 7% since 2015. And the top three reasons landlords gave for partnering with the Housing Commission were, number one, not unimportant, consistent and on-time payments. 84.6% said we were on time. Unit inspections occurring every 2 years rather than 1 year, as had been the case before. That's 37% response. And that the landlord still controls the selecting of residents to go into his or her property. That's right at 34% as well. So I think what the survey results show is that not only do we serve the customers who need our services, but we're good partners with those who actually provide the roofs over their heads in the voucher program. And it's a good reflection, I think, on us and Zaina Valladolid. Zaina, are you here? And Jeff, would you tell that Zaina I said good things about her? As well as our housing assistance staff on the third floor who run the voucher program and who are the backbone of this organization. They serve some 15,400 residents and are the basis that everything else kind of spins off of here. So with that, Madam Chair, it concludes my report. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll move on to the approval of the meeting of the minutes from the January 11th meeting. Do we have a motion? Second? Moved by Commissioner Davis and seconded by Commissioner Plumner. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye. Okay. Motion carries. Thank you. We have on our consent agenda item 100 and 101. Is there any discussion? Would anyone like to pull an item? No. Okay. Do we have a motion to move the consent agenda? Thank you. Thank you. Moved by Commissioner Hubbard, seconded by Commissioner Davis. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Motion carries. Thank you very much. And now we're off. Let's see if I can move us along quickly on this. Item 102, we have the final bond authorization for the Harborview Apartments. And I believe he needs a clicker. Unless you want me to give you a remote, I don't know.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Commissioners, Mr. Gentry. My name is Colin Miller. I'm the Vice President of Multifamily Housing Finance. And the item before you this morning is a request that the Housing Commission, Housing Authority, authorize the issuance of up to $10 million in multifamily housing revenue bonds for the rehabilitation of Harborview Apartments, an existing 60-unit multifamily development located at 404 North 47th Street in the Encanto community in Council District 4. This property was originally constructed in 1985. And these units will remain affordable for 55 years. In addition, staff is requesting that City Council hold a Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act public hearing, also called TEFRA, and adopt a resolution approving the issuance of multifamily housing revenue bonds. A TEFRA hearing for Harborview was held on April 8, 2018, and the resulting TEFRA approval will expire on April 9, 2019, prior to the issuance of bonds. The IRS code requires a new TEFRA hearing and approval. The new TEFRA hearing is anticipated to be held on March 12, 2019. As I mentioned, Harborview is an existing 60-unit multifamily development located in Council District 4. The development consists of 10 two-story residential buildings with 24 two-bedroom and 35 three-bedroom units, manager unit, management office, and community room. Site amenities include laundry facilities, barbecue area, and courtyard. The owner intends to complete a comprehensive renovation, including new roofs, windows, kitchen cabinets, appliances, flooring, water heaters, as well as improvements to the common areas. The developer of the project will be the current owner, And during the 15-year tax credit compliance period, it will be owned by Harborview SD Partners, LP, a limited partnership comprised of Harborview GP, LLC, acting as the administrative general partner, and Central Valley Coalition for Affordable Housing, acting as the managing general partner. The tax credit investor is to be determined. The developer is requesting and the issuance of bonds in the amount of up to $10 million, and there are no housing commission funds proposed for the project. The total development cost of the project will be approximately $13.8 million, which will be financed with a combination of 4% tax credits, tax-exempt multifamily housing revenue bonds, income from operations, GP equity, and a deferred developer fee. Under the proposed financing, restricted rents will range from 50% of area median income to 60% of area median income, as seen on the slide and Table 6 of the staff report. Approval of the bond issuance and TAFRA resolutions does not commit the Housing Commission or authority to issue bonds. The bonds would not constitute a debt of the city. If the bonds are ultimately issued for the project, the bonds will not financially obligate the city, the Housing Authority, or Housing Commission, because the security of the, for the repayment of the bonds will be limited to specific private revenue sources of the project. The requested actions are the final steps to issue bonds, and the project is estimated to close financing in April 2019 and complete rehabilitation this year in October 2019. This concludes the presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have at this time.
Thank you, Colin. Commissioners, any questions? No? Wow. Fantastic.
Thank you.
I spoke quickly about this moving fast. I think I was right. Is there a motion? Moved by Commissioner Walsh. Seconded by Commissioner Klumpner. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye. And good. Motion carries. Thank you. Thank you, Colin. All right. Our next item is item 103. The accreditor agreement for Veterans Village, intercreditor agreement for the Veterans Village of San Diego campus.
I drew the short stick here, so I'm going to give this presentation.
Thanks, Jack.
No problem. Item 103 is, you can tell how. There we go. This matter is an action item to bring forward an approval of what they call an intercreditor agreement. It's an agreement between borrowers, in this case VBSD, the City of San Diego, who is the successor agency for the Redevelopment Agency, and the San Diego Housing Commission. The purpose of the intercreditor agreement is to make changes to the loan agreements that both the City of San Diego and the Housing Commission have made concerning the project. There are two changes that were requested by VBSD, and the Commission is in complete support of. The first is to allow non-veterans to occupy beds at the facility. VBSD requested permission to do that from the Veterans Administration, and that permission was granted. And so with respect to that, we've been talking as well to the City of San Diego, and the City of San Diego is willing to agree to that change, and the Commission is as well. In addition, there are instances where a homeless veteran comes into the facility and receives disability benefits that kicks their eligibility outside the range of that's permissible. Generally at the site, and there are five phases shown on this chart, or phases, one through five. The phases along, Pacific Coast Highway are phase one, and it goes throughout the project. As the veterans come into the site and they get disability payments, they usually come in and are qualified at or below 60% of the area median income. When they get those disability payments, it often kicks them up over that 60% level and then would disqualify them from remaining in the site. So one of the action items that we're asking approval for today is to allow up to 49 additional units to be affordable at or below 80% of area median income. Already there are two on the project that are affordable at or below 80% of area median income. This slide shows that the purpose of the amendment to the intercreditor agreement is to help ensure maximum occupancy of the campus, and as I said before, to allow occupancy up to 80% and for non-veterans. That would occur for non-veterans only if there weren't sufficient number of veterans to occupy the project. And the entire campus, all five phases, will benefit from the proposed changes. This slide is sort of an outline of the financial investment of the San Diego Housing Commission on the project. Over a period of years, the commission has either loaned or granted $9.9 million, which funds up to 364 beds. As I said before, there are a number of different occupancy levels. Some of the beds are to be occupied at or below 60%, and 50% and 30% currently. This slide shows the 80% change that's being proposed, so that the total number of beds that could be occupied at or below 80% are 51, up from 2. That concludes our, I wanted to indicate that we've had just very, very good discussions with VVSD. They're a great partner, and we've collaboratively worked together to try to come to this resolution. Jeff Davis and the CEO have been involved, and we've been speaking with Kim Mitchell, who's the CEO of Veterans Village, who's here today, together with Andre Simpson, who's the CFO of Veterans VVSD. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them. And the staff would request approval of the two action items.
Thank you, Chuck. Do we have questions from commissioners?
I don't have a question, really. I have a comment. This is wonderful. I'm all for this. I personally know someone whose brother is right in that hairline. I think he was $10 over or something. And he's actually been having to sleep in his car off and on because and he has a full-time job. He works hard. He's a veteran. But he was made $10 too much, so he couldn't qualify for help. So this is amazing, and I'm very for it. Thank you.
Well, yeah, thank you. That is exactly the kind of thing that we're trying to avoid here, and we think this will be a very, very good change.
I'll also point out that the relationship between VVSD and the Housing Commission has never been better. The VVSD folks are doing some wonderful work over there. And basically what this request does is to free VVSD from some over-regulation that unduly hampers the way they do their job. It frees them up, gives them a little more latitude, and allow them to better serve their customer base and expand it a bit.
I appreciate the agility with which the commission has approached this issue. I think that flexibility is going to be very helpful. As Commissioner Davis was mentioning, there are people who get sidelined inadvertently by some of these regulations that are meant to help the very populations that they're targeting. I just want to clarify that we're comfortable from the staff perspective that this won't jeopardize any other source of funding by sort of turning these knobs this way or that.
Yes, as a matter of fact, one of the challenges originally was to make sure that didn't happen. And under the federal home regulations, 92 Part C of there is an ability for a public agency to fund up to 80% on an agency-wide basis, and we're taking advantage of that on this project. There Generally, the funding, as you all know, is at or below 60, but this is permissible. And in addition, when the annual plan goes forward, because there's a small amount of local funds in, I believe we're going to put a provision in there that would allow those funds to be used also up to 80%. So, but to answer your question, even if that isn't approved, we're authorized to do this now, provided we get the approval at the Housing Authority level.
Excellent. Thank you.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen many of these intercreditor agreements in my short time on the commission. This may be the first one, actually, if I recall. So in trying to think as a steward, not just for my time on the commission, but years forward, let me ask what's the obvious question. If availability is used for non-veterans, and of course we don't ever want an unused bed in today's environment, and that bed is filled with a non-veteran, is there the potential, as we see population changes coming, that the beds would be filled and there would not be a gap down the road for a veteran that they may need that bed at some point in time? And if that did occur, what might that timeline be?
That's a very good and difficult question to answer. With respect to that, I believe the turnover is relatively constant at the facility. And so, and there is adequate capacity now, substantial capacity. Matter of fact, that's one of the reasons they've asked to be able to put non-veterans in. The language will say that these beds will only be available if there are not veterans that are eligible. I guess it's possible that there could be a short period of time where there would not be a bed available, but I think it's highly unlikely. The intercreditor agreement will require that the veterans continue to get preference. And, to the extent they're waiting lists, I think they can sort of juggle that to make sure that situation doesn't occur. So a long-winded way of saying it could happen, but I don't think it's likely.
Okay, with that, we'll entertain a motion. By Commissioner Davis, seconded by Commissioner Hester. Thank you. Any further discussion? All in favor? Great. Motion carries. Thank you. Next up, item 104 will be an approval of the contract renewal between the Housing Commission and Mental Health Systems to operate the Transitional Storage Center. And we will have speakers on this item. So thank you to those of you that filled out the slip.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Jeff Davis, Executive Vice President and Chief of Staff. With me is Lisa Jones, Senior Vice President of Homeless Housing Innovations. This morning, we are presenting to you the proposed contract renewal for the operation of the City of San Diego's Storage Connect Center, which was previously known as the Transitional Storage Center. The center helps keep homeless San Diegans' belongings off of downtown streets, sidewalks, and storefronts by providing a safe place for persons experiencing homelessness to keep their belongings as they look for work, attend classes, or meet with service providers. This center augments existing storage center services that have been operated by Think Dignity since 2011. The storage center meets a need within the homeless community. The center is operated by Mental Health Systems and opened in June 2018. It provides up to 500 storage bins for individuals experiencing homelessness. The center has 3 inventory specialists on staff conducting client intakes and bin assignments and assisting clients with ongoing access to containers in a supervised staging area. In addition, they provide linkages and referrals to other appropriate resources to address the client's needs. The storage center is open Monday through Friday from 7 to 7 and Saturday and Sunday from 8 to 1. I beg your pardon, from 8 to 11. To proactively address community concerns, several good neighbor policies were built into the operating contract requirements. Staff from Mental Health Systems work in various capacities to best serve clients, maintain a clean and safe environment, and conduct proactive outreach in the surrounding communities. Mental Health System provides 24-hour security, a dedicated operator contact, and coordinates with other city departments such as the police department and San Diego Environmental Services Department. Outreach workers from the Storage Connect Center and the city's 3 bridge shelters regularly coordinate outreach and engagement activities in the area to engage individuals experiencing homelessness and to offer them services. The outreach workers also engage with community members they encounter to provide information and gather input. Since opening, the center's outreach staff have engaged with a total of 328 individuals. They were provided 25 individuals with referrals to mental health services, 27 with referrals to medical services, and 49 to food resources. The center has 24-hour security via security guards and security cameras, and the San Diego Police Department coordinates ongoing law enforcement and security presence within the center's security agency daily. Mental Health Systems holds monthly community advisory committee meetings to provide community members with an opportunity to share concerns and ideas, and allows project partners to share information and updates with the community. Monthly meetings include ongoing attendance by Housing Commission staff and city representatives from the San Diego Police Department, Environmental Services, and the Mayor's Office. 58 people attended the committee meeting in June, 26 in July, 17 in August, 10 in September, 10 in October, and 15 in November, and 31 in January. In addition, the Housing Commission hosts a dedicated phone line available to community members to raise questions or concerns. No calls have been received on this phone line since the center opened. I'll now turn it over to Lisa, who will provide you with an overview of the program status.
On October 13th, the center reached full capacity with all 500 storage bins allocated to clients. The proposed contract renewal would continue operations at the current capacity of 500 storage bins. As of February 4th, the Storage Connect Center had a waiting list of 227 homeless individuals, and the Homeless Transitional Storage Center, operated by Think Dignity, had a waiting list of 106 individuals experiencing homelessness. This slide shows the daily new client enrollments since the center opened. From June 13th through November 30th, the center has conducted 558 new client enrollments for a total of 500 bins being utilized at any one time. This data was through November. More recent data shows that 619 distinct individuals have been served. This slide indicates the number of times clients return to access their storage belongings since center opening. Since opening, there were 9,610 return visits from enrolled clients. As of February 5, 2019, a total of 488 clients are enrolled and utilizing the Storage Connect Center. Since opening, clients have been referred to the center from a variety of sources. In the first 90 days of operation, the majority of center clients were referred from the San Diego Police Department. Since then, clients have been referred from sources including the waiting list for the Transitional Storage Center wait list operated by Think Dignity, the San Diego Police Department, other service providers, and other center clients. In addition to providing storage space for individuals experiencing homelessness, one of the program's functions is to connect their clients with mainstream supportive services that will assist with their efforts to obtain permanent housing. Since opening, the center referred 416 individuals to resources, which includes 44 referrals to healthcare, 41 referrals to housing search and information, 40 referrals to income support and employment, and 46 referrals to mental health and substance use disorder services. Center clients are demographically diverse. Since opening, 8% of all clients who have been served by the center have identified as veterans. 29% identify as 55 years of age or older. And 3% identify as transitionally aged youth, which is 18 to 24. There was also a typo noted in the staff report for the percentage fleeing domestic violence. The correct number is on the slide and is 3.4%, not 34%. In addition, 44% of all clients served by the center identify as chronically homeless, and 32% of all clients identify as an individual with a mental health need. The cost to operate the center annually includes the lease for the center space, as well as the operating cost and original tenant improvement costs. The total lease costs for fiscal year 2018 and fiscal year 2019 are $261,737.67. And the total lease cost for fiscal year 2020 would be $202,168.40. The total cost to operate the center in year one, including the initial startup costs and the proposed two-month extension, is $1,426,729.26.
The two-month extension would bring the contract term into alignment with the Housing Commission's fiscal year. The projected cost to operate the center in year two is $1,190,828.40. Staff is requesting that the board recommend the Housing Authority of the City of San Diego take the following actions. Approve a two-month extension of the contract term for the current agreement with Mental Health Systems for the operation of the City of San Diego Storage Connect Center for an amended term of May 13, 2018 through June 30, 2019. Amend the contract budget to accommodate the two additional operating months in the amended term at the current capacity of 500 bins for an adjusted budget of $1,426,729.26. Staff also recommends Housing Authority approval of the execution of the first one-year renewal option of the agreement with Mental Health Systems to operate the center for a term of July 1, 2019 through June 30, 2020, with a corresponding budget at the current capacity of 500 bins with an annual budget amount of $190,828.40. In addition, it is recommended that Housing Authority authorize the President and Chief Executive Officer to execute the agreement and any and all other documents and agreements that are necessary to implement these approvals. It is also recommended that the Housing Authority authorize the allocation and expenditure of funds in the fiscal year 2020 Housing Commission budget to support the payment of building lease costs for the lease to be renewed by the City of San Diego for the center, and authorize the President and CEO to substitute funding sources and or increase funding under the agreement by not more than 20% of the original amount. That concludes our presentations. We're available to answer any questions. We also have Keely Halsey, Chief of Homeless Strategy for the Mayor's Office, present, and Laura Otis Miles and Rich Penksa, the leadership team from Mental Health Systems, available as well.
Thank you both. We do have two speaker slips. I would like to invite Keely Halsey to come and speak, and behind her will be Father John Author, I believe. I'm sorry.
Good morning. I'm Keely Halsey, Chief of Homelessness Strategies and Housing Liaison for the City of San Diego. Thank you, Board of Commissioners, for your consideration in continuing this important service for the homeless community. I'm here on behalf of the mayor, who asks for your recommendation today. And I'll read from my notes if that's okay with you. In addition to the recommendation today, we are also committed to finding additional storage solutions for those who need this service. We know from the significant wait list at the Think Dignity and Sherman Heights facilities that there's a high demand for this service. Whether this service allows for an individual to attend school, seek employment assistance, or simply have peace of mind that his or her belongings are safe during the day, it's clear that there's a demand among our neighbors who are experiencing homelessness. And it stands to reason that, just as our homeless population is dispersed throughout the communities of our city, so is the need for this basic service. So to that end, the mayor is considering several options for increasing storage capacity. That's both by lifting the Housing Authority cap at the Sherman Heights Center to use the empty portions of the warehouse, as well as adding one or more facilities in other areas of the city where there is need. I've attended many community meetings and meetings with the mayor and city staff on this topic, and their interests are fundamentally aligned. Serving our homeless population and protecting the quality of life for the community. For its part, the mayor has demonstrated the city's commitment by providing additional public safety and cleanliness resources in the Sherman Heights and East Village communities. We make no mistake, storage is not a home. Storage is not on its own a means to end an individual's homelessness. However, it can be part of an overall solution. The city storage system allows each individual experiencing homelessness an opportunity to connect with someone who cares, someone who will connect them with the services that they need. And in some cases, the opportunity for storage is our only opportunity to incentivize individuals to interact with the many services our nonprofit, city, housing commission, and county providers have to offer. We recognize that this is a new approach for San Diego. We recognize that we need to do data-driven decision-making to continually improve the way we move people from their first experience using the facility into housing. And we thank each member of the Housing Commission for standing with us as we take steps to reduce homelessness in San Diego. Thank you.
Father author. Please tell me your last name.
Oh, good.
Okay. Please, Charlie Mike, 3 minutes.
Okay. First of all, I come on behalf of my parish, our school. We are now spending $60,000 of security because that storage facility was put there, because we don't trust that our children will be safe. So it's really an expensive proposition for us to have that there. But I really don't want to talk about the effects on our area, although I could go over a list that I have since the storage facility opened of all the different ways that homeless people have caused problems in our parish and in our school. And I have a long list of that. But really, you know, we're willing in our community to help with the homeless. But I'd like to just point out that we're part of a quarter square mile or a half square mile of the city of San Diego, of 370 square miles. And in that part of San Diego, probably 60 to 70 to 80% of transient homeless services are focused insofar as dealing with people day by day in that small area. This is bad for the homeless themselves. When I was working with drug and alcohol addicted people, the last thing I wanted them to do was to be in our area of town, because it is too, it's too easy to get drugs and alcohol. Concentrating the homeless in one area is not wise. I would like the Housing Commission to propose to the city that no other facilities will be allowed in this small area, 1 square mile of 370 square miles. The city has had over a year since the mayor's last State of the City address to find other storage facilities. If you look at the Think Dignity, it requires a fence and a construction trailer, and everything else can be put in garbage bins as they do. It's not hard to find places that would do that, but there's no will to do that until you come up and say, no more facilities, no more transit service in this particular area. The last point, this is not about finding a place for a homeless storage thing. What this is about is settling a lawsuit so that the city can give people 3 hours to move their encampments instead of 72 hours. That's been clear from the very beginning, that this is not to help homeless. It's to harass homeless people. So they have to move within 72 hours, or they have to move within 3 hours instead of 72 hours. It's been clear. The city does not really care about them storing the facilities. They want to settle those lawsuits. And now that the storage facility is full, they have to, now they can't give them the 3 hours. They have to give them 72 hours. This is what this is about. This is to harass the homeless. If this were helpful to the homeless, we would have statistics showing how many transition from their contacts with mental health systems into a home. We have no statistics like that because it's happening at such a pathetically low level. This is about harassing, hurting the homeless, concentrating them in one area, which is unhealthy for them, and getting them to move with only 3 hours. If that's what your Housing Commission wants to support, a vote for the renewal of this contract. But I don't think that's what you should be about.
Thank you. I would like to ask staff, just to start off this, the question portion, to walk us through, the last speaker was mentioning the lawsuit, and I think it would be helpful to make sure that all the commissioners understand kind of the situation that the city is in and how some things have evolved, but the lawsuit is certainly something that I'd like to make sure we're all on the same page about. So if you wouldn't mind, or okay.
Keely. I would recommend that the city provides that information.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Think Dignity site predated the settlement that I believe the speaker was alluding to. So the city's commitment to storage is independent of any lawsuit. However, the city on the, during the height of the hepatitis A crisis, looked at the court order that applies to the environmental services procedure for removing items that are left on the sidewalks that appear to be abandoned personal property that may belong to a homeless individual. There's a specific procedure that dictates that notice has to be provided 72 hours in advance before any abatement can occur. and that's been in place for years, independent, again, of storage. What we worked out during the hepatitis A outbreak was that in order for our crews to be able to adequately sanitize the streets, that if we provided storage options, the city would be allowed to post a 3-hour notice rather than wait a 72-hour notice. And that was due to the need related to public health. So currently, that court order is still in place. The Housing Authority has the ability to lift the cap, the 500 bin cap it imposed when it approved this item last time, at which time the city would be permitted to use the 3-hour noticing procedure until the Sherman Heights facility reached its capacity once again. Does that
Thank you. Help? Yes, and I know that Rick also had some comments on this item. Go ahead.
I think one of those, thank you. Yeah, a little bit of history. The Think Dignity side is on Housing Commission-owned property. And the Housing Commission made the decision to lease that site for, I think, $1 a year to Think Dignity, the old girls' think tank before they, thank goodness, changed the name, about 4 years ago. And we made that decision on our own based on our own focus on homelessness needs. And that site was then, which was a vacant parking lot, got fenced with bins put in by Think Dignity, and it's been a great rousing success over the years. And it is full with the waiting list and has been for several years. It proved, I think, as a good prototype when the city decided about a year and a half ago that there was a need for an additional storage space for the homeless. As Ms. Halsey indicated, there was the hepatitis A epidemic at the time. There was partly because of that and partly for broader reasons, there was a focus by the city to give additional resources to get people off the streets. It included the 3 housing shelters with the storage as part of that. And this agency did support those actions and agreed to implement decisions made by the city. I'll point out that the location of the shelters as well as the location of the storage facility is entirely the purview of the city, and we've agreed to support city decision as the city makes those location decisions. And what we're here recommending to you all today is not the location of the site, although we see no reason not to support it, is to approve our implementation of the city's program at that site going forward.
Thank you. And I don't want to rehash the hepatitis situation and everything that happened last year. Instead, I brought up the lawsuit because I think the time frame for sidewalk cleanup and the sanitary decisions that have to be made by the city is something that we, as part of the homeless service continuum, need to be aware of. These are things that impact the community, that really do make a difference for the residents around the area, and make sure that we are all moving together in the same direction with the same goal of really addressing the fact that there are humans out there without a home, without stability, without services. So I think that having capacity for storage is important because it has two mutual goals. It keeps our streets in a situation where people feel safe and comfortable in their own communities. And it also allows homeless folks to understand that their what little they have is safe, is cared for, and they are respected as they move forward and try to find services. I'm wholeheartedly in support of this item. I just wanted to clarify that I was not trying to relitigate the hepatitis A situation, but instead to make sure that we all understood what we were looking at. Very much so. Sir, I'm sorry, that is not how we're going to run this meeting. I very much appreciate the comments. I would very much encourage you to submit a letter. Please feel free to email us. You can get all that information to the commissioners through staff. Thank you. Do any of the other commissioners have comments? Commissioner Davis.
I definitely believe in and support storage containers for the homeless, and I am very pleased with what I've understood how it's helped in Sherman Heights. My only comment is I do agree that there shouldn't be additional bins in the particular Sherman Heights location that is at its 500 limit right now. However, I'm very much for additional storage containers in different locations, and I know there was an option, I believe, from the mayor's office, the lady said she mentioned both in this location or other locations. I'd like to submit that, in my opinion, it would be much better to not increase the Sherman Heights at all and to look at other locations to help with other storage.
Just a few questions, if you don't mind. How long is the wait list? Ballpark. You don't have to give me the exact number, of course.
So the wait list has about 230 on it for mental health systems, so the one we're talking about. And mm-hmm. then the Think Dignity wait list has 106.
So we're looking at a give or take 350-ish one way or another.
And we also cross-referenced that. There's only 10 duplicate names between those two wait lists.
Okay, so if we were going to operate at full need, to satisfy full need today, we'd need 300 plus, give or take more.
For this particular
site in this particular area. Just that frame of reference is important for us as we think going forward what's needed. Also, trying to recognize our role, which is very different than the Housing Authority role, and I think Mr. Gentry labeled out what we're looking at here today. I would be remiss if I didn't say that everyone is sensitive to community impacts, and I do think part of the Housing Commission's job is to provide data. That's a big part of what the Housing Commission does. And as we've gone on this journey to address the challenges of homelessness in San Diego, the Housing Commission, in my humble opinion, has done a remarkable job finding data and doing program evaluation, what works, what doesn't. And that information has guided the Housing Authority to make good decisions. And I'm not speaking on their behalf, but I believe they would say they've appreciated it. And so I think it's incumbent upon us, as we have this data, which is excellent data, which shows us who's using these facilities and the needs there, also to try to gather as best we can data on the impacts to local communities. And so, especially because these are such emotionally charged items, and so that as we reevaluate this contract, it'd be great to figure out exactly what is the impact as we see it. I think there was a statement made, and I'm certain that everything was intended to be truthful, and reflecting certainly from the school is truthful. I wouldn't know that, but I'm sure there's no reason to lie about any of that, right? But these are emotionally charged things, so I would encourage us to collect data, and hypothetically maybe it would be on, is there additional public safety cost to that? Are there additional calls? What are the complaints that come in? Because a lot of the data you shared with us, much of the fear hasn't been borne out, at least from my recollection of the meeting a year ago. That doesn't mean there aren't other problems. And I'm not belittling the challenges that a community faces with this, but I would encourage us to pursue that data. And then I have one small detailed question, and then I'll be quiet for a while. I'm a little more sleep-deprived now than normally. So there's a two-month extension and a year extension. Could you just tell me why that is? I kept looking and I kept missing.
Right. I understand that. We had a hard time figuring out how to lay that out well. Yeah. So the operator contract originally ran from May 13th through May 12th. So it started in May 13th, 2018 through May 12th, 2019, which is out of alignment with our fiscal year. And it just makes things a little more complicated. So we added a two-month extension to the current contract to bring it in alignment with our fiscal year, and then the renewal going forward for 2020 fiscal year, July 2019 through June 2020.
Thank you.
Yep. I know I keep in mind the homeless person story that I hear too, opposite of, you know, taking away the bins, the many times their things have been thrown away, folks that needs to throw them away, whatever, right? Like whoever does that cleaning, EVS, I imagine the city, whomever. So I feel that there's value to people's ability to store their things as they are going through this very difficult time, hopefully a phase in their life, and we're hoping to help them out of that phase. I also am sympathetic to the notion that, we cannot
put homeless folks in one location and sort of like forming this almost ghettoizing, right? Like this population. So so that idea resonates with me. Do we have other bin locations, or is this just the first location, or?
So this location that's on 20th and Commercial is the second storage unit location. The other one is on 17th, just north of Imperial. So there's two within about a mile radius of each other. Mm-hmm. And that's where Ms. Halsey had mentioned that the City Council and Housing Authority last year, when they approved this, requested the city to look at locations throughout the community that also have high need.
Okay. Doubtful, but I'll try. Two or three, just disparate points. Number one, again, I'll remind you that the Think Dignity location, which has been a storage facility for about 4 years, just happens to be where it is because that happened to be a vacant lot owned by the Housing Commission. It was a parking lot. And it's frankly too small to really do any significant housing out. And we were trying to decide what to do with it. About the same time that the Think Dignity leadership asked for that site to put storage on. About the time that the Celadon property here was built, which is where the previous storage was in an old site that got torn down. So that got torn down. We agreed to step in and just gave our site to the Think Dignity for $1 a year. That's been wildly successful. One, that's a separate issue. The new issue is the current larger storage facility that has the 500 bins in it that the city selected a year and a half ago and asked us to administer beginning about a year ago. I'm sorry, I was recovering from surgery last March when that discussion was held. I'm sorry I missed that one. It sounded like it was quite interesting, to say the least. So what we did was to support and agree with and agree to administer the city decision on this location. What we brought to you today is an approval, a reauthorization in two parts to align to the fiscal year of current capacity only. 500, nothing more. Period, fact, end, that's it. However, if the city administration comes back and recommends more use of the site, we'll bring it back to you. Because this is a building, a warehouse that's currently woefully underutilized. Now, there can be neighborhood support, there can be neighborhood opposition. I'm not getting into that, sir. But the building itself could be much greater utilized at marginal cost. That's one issue. The other issue is, do you put other storage facilities elsewhere? And we could get in all kinds of arguments on whether you follow the population, recreate something that they'll follow. I mean, we could argue that till the cows come home. But what we're asking you all to do today with our staff support and my support is to authorize in two stages the reauthorization of current capacity only going forward. Jeff, there's nothing else, right? Lisa, great.
So I have a couple questions. One, you mentioned that there's been no calls to the hotline that was provided. Where's that number posted?
So that number actually is given out at every single community meeting group. So we have monthly community meeting groups except for December, where we didn't have one for December just due to obviously the holidays. Then there are flyers both in English and Spanish. We also have our outreach workers that have that as well. The MHS operator has that flyer, and that also the community group created their own website and Facebook page, and that information is posted there as well. We actually received 4 calls, just none related to the storage center. In fact, it looked like they were wrong numbers.
Wow. Okay. And then, not to revisit the 3-hour versus the 72-hour again, but I just want to be clear here. The word abandoned property was used, so just so that I understand this, the 3 hours that is required now, that is in reference to property that is believed to be abandoned, correct?
I'm a lawyer by training, so I'm not really a lawyer here today, but I can try to parse out the litigation
sure.
and the settlement. So typically when there is, if there's anything left behind on a sidewalk, a city is just allowed to come by and treat it as trash and throw it out. But due to a legal settlement, litigation that resulted in a settlement and a court order, we treat property that with when the individual is not there, so you, the city comes across a piece of property and the individual is not with the property, in a special manner. And so there's a very detailed multi-step protocol that goes along with that. Code compliance officers come, they post the 72 hours. If no one's returned to move the property within 72 hours, they go through a rigorous process of sorting the items, discarding only that which is soiled or infested, saving everything else that is salvageable and storing it for that individual in a city facility for a period of 90 days. So the 72 hours just refers, the protocol is the same. The city goes through that rigorous process for any item that appears to possibly belong to a homeless individual. The protocol remains the same. The difference is only the period of noticing that needs to occur to give the opportunity to the person to come remove the belongings before that protocol is initiated.
Thank you. So, I mean, that sounds like a very thoughtful and compassionate process in my mind as to how we deal with abandoned property on the streets. And I'm not really sure how we even managed to do that with a 72-hour. 72 hours is a really long time. And so the fact that we treat that property with that care and provide 3 hours notice seems like, I mean, it sounds like it's clearly up far above and beyond what most cities do. And there's reasons for that. And I think those reasons are good. So I understand, thank you, by the way. I understand the concerns from the surrounding area. I'm kind of troubled by the wait list because it seems like this is a service that's being, very well utilized. It seems like, to have vacant space available to us that we're not utilizing for this is a huge disservice, to the population of people who are experiencing homelessness. And I don't doubt that the concerns that people around feel are real, but they also, you know, remind me of other concerns that we hear on other issues related to permanent supportive housing, landlords that don't want to accept vouchers, all these issues, the security concerns and everything. We all are going to have concerns about how to deal with this population. But I think that the important thing is that we not let those concerns drive the policy, because we owe it to this population and to the population at large that we deal with this in a compassionate manner. And so, I mean, I would like to see the capacity expanded, but given the item before us, I'll settle for just, you know, supporting what we have here. Thank you. Yes.
Go ahead, Commissioner Hubbard.
Okay, I have a question. It's in regards to something I believe Father Arthur had mentioned, which kind of piqued my interest. Maybe it's just clarification that I need. But do we have statistics on the clients that have successfully transitioned, I guess, to housing and moved their things out of the storage bins? And if we do not, why is that?
Right. So actually, we just ran some initial data over the last couple of weeks, and we have had some downtime in data because the data warehouse homeless management information system that all of that MHS inputs data into went through a software transition over the last couple of months. So it's made getting some of the updated data more challenging, which is why what you saw in the report was November data. But there have been 50 exits to permanent housing. So of the client in implemented exits, which were 75 exits, 50 exited to permanent housing since the center opened on June 13th.
Okay, so we have a motion. Seconded. Any further discussion, commissioners? No.
call the question. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much. And I would just like to reiterate that if there is information or something that the community or anyone else would like the commissioners to be aware of, that please submit that information. We would very much appreciate the opportunity to review that and to learn more. So thank you. Okay. You'll have to excuse my shuffling. And on to item 105, the loan recommendation for the Ivy Senior Apartments. Welcome back, Colin.
Good morning. Colin Miller again. I'm joined by Joe Correa, Senior Project Manager. And Joe will be giving the presentation for the Ivy Senior Apartments loan recommendation.
Good morning, Commissioners. This item is Ivy Senior Apartments loan recommendation. And it has two recommendations. First, that the Housing Commission approve a residual receipts loan up to $6,500,000 to Mount Alafan Apartments LP for new construction of 52 affordable rental housing units for homeless seniors. It's to be located at 5858 Mount Alafan Drive. It will remain affordable for 55 years. Second recommendation is to authorize the President and Chief Executive Officer to execute documents, adjust terms as necessary, perform acts necessary, convenient, or appropriate to implement with the General Counsel's advice, and the substitute funds if necessary. The up to $6,500,000 proposed total loan may not increase. As I said, this proposed new construction, 52 affordable rental housing units for homeless seniors aged 55 and over, plus one manager's unit. The proposed mix is 52 studio units in one building with three stories. This is a 1.2-acre site. It currently has an existing office building with 20 business tenants, no residential tenants. The existing office building will need to be demolished. Permanent relocation of the 20 business tenants is necessary. The developer's relocation consultant will assist the business tenants with applicable relocation benefits. This proposal supports Housing First San Diego, the Commission's homelessness action plan. There are development details summary at Table 1, Page 2 of the report. The developer is Wakeland Housing and Development Corporation. They're an experienced, award-winning, nonprofit developer. They're located in San Diego. Wakeland has previously obtained Housing Commission loans and has successfully implemented them. Supportive services for the tenants will be provided by St. Paul's PACE and People Assisting the Homeless, also known as PATH. The development team summary is in Table 2, Page 4 of the report. I have location maps included with the report. This location shows you roughly where it is. It's just east of Genesee, south of Balboa, west, slightly south of the shopping center, which has the Home Depot, the 99 Ranch Market, the Target, the DMV for Claremont Mesa. That gives you an idea of the plat map showing you roughly where it's located. Estimated sources and uses are summarized in Table 3, Page 5 of the report. Wakeland is requesting $6.5 million as residual receipts loan from the Commission. If you approve today's action, they will be applying for State Tax Credit Allocation Committee approval for competitive 9% tax credits. Also, they have applied for a loan from the County of San Diego. Under the current FY 2018 Permanent Supportive Housing Notice of Funds Available, the developer applied for and received preliminary recommendation of award for 52 federal project-based housing vouchers. Total development cost is $18,963,831. That comes out to $357,808 per unit. The project costs do include prevailing wage because of the vouchers and also because of the use of certain home funds. There is a summary in Table 4 with key performance indicators at Page 5. There's a summary in Table 5 with comparable development projects at Page 6. affordability will range from 30% area median income to 50% area median income. Affordability is summarized in Table 6, page 6 of the report. Estimated timeline. With your approval of today's proposal, the developer would apply for Tax Credit Allocation Committee 9% application on March 4. And if that is successful, the Tax Credit Allocation Committee would approve it at a meeting of June 12. Estimated escrow closing and construction could start as early as December of this year. And estimated construction completion approximately September of 2021. This is an artist's rendering of what it will look like. Very nice looking building. With us available for questions are representatives from Wakeland. And let me turn it over to you for questions.
Thank you. I just real fast, the report says this is in Council District 3. Is that?
My apologies. The first page and the executive summary do correctly say it's
Okay, yeah. So
there is a typo, with my apologies.
I looked at the wrong
table. Table 1.
Yeah.
No, you were right. I was wrong.
This is a fun game. I only point that out because it's kind of near my neighborhood, and I am very excited to see this development going in here. I think it looks wonderful. I am curious about... I did see that there's county funds also being allocated to it. Is this part of the county's 25 locations that they put forth? And you're not county spokespeople, so if you don't know the answer, that's also fine.
Well, perhaps the developer can give us a quick answer to that. I know we call out in the report that it's special needs housing program funds.
Can we bother you on this one real fast? Sorry. It's not. Okay, thank you. That's easy peasy. Great. I love that. Thanks so much. I also just wanted to call out real quickly that this is a great use of our housing trust fund dollars being leveraged to go further in a community that certainly will benefit from the new neighborhood, the new neighbors that they'll be adding, and I'm very much looking forward to it. I'm very in support, you might be able to tell. I think, Rick, you have comments?
Just a couple. Wakeland is a longtime partner with the Housing Commission. They do excellent work. Nobody in town does better than Ken and his folks. And Pace and Path as well. We have long-term relationships and other properties with them. So this is a nice team. We feel good about it. And the location, I'll go back to something Ms. Davis said a while ago, and Chair Benvenuto, the location of this, well north of the 8th, is good at spreading our resources out as well. So this is a good one.
I would just like to add that this is also sort of near my soon-to-be neighborhood, and my partner has a lot of family over there, and we look forward to welcoming our new neighbors as well.
Okay, do we have a motion? Thank you, Commissioner Davis. Seconded by Commissioner Hester. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carries. Thank you very much. Okay. And next, we'll be moving on to item 106, the loan recommendation for Hollister. It looks like we do have one speaker.
Good morning. I'm just going to sit up here for a while, if that's okay. This item is a request that the San Diego Housing Commission approve a residual receipts loan of up to $4,860,000 for Hollister Apartments LP. In addition, staff requests approval for the Housing Commission President and CEO, or designee, to adjust financing as necessary, provided that the proposed $4,860,000 maximum loan amount not increase, substitute approved funding sources, and take actions necessary upon advice of Housing Commission General Counsel to implement the approvals. The Hollister Apartments is a proposed rehabilitation 83-unit permit-supportive housing complex. The proposed project will provide 82 affordable living units, approximately 240 square feet each, for chronically homeless persons and individuals with a disability who are experiencing homelessness, and one two-bedroom manager unit. Affordable units will remain affordable for 55 years. The development has received an award of 82 federal project-based Section 8 rental assistance vouchers as part of the Housing First San Diego, the Housing Commission's Homelessness Action Plan. Loan funds were awarded through the Multifamily Rehabilitation Notice funding availability. The project site is currently occupied with a three-story Easy 8 motel located at 1010 Outer Road in the Otay Mesa Nestor Community Plan Area of Council District 8, as shown on the map here. Renovations to unit interiors as well as site improvements are planned. The 88-room configuration will be rehabilitated, ultimately creating 82 permanent supportive housing units with kitchenettes and private bathrooms, as well as one manager unit, as I mentioned before. Additionally, the existing pool and spa will be removed. The developer of the project will be SVDP Management Incorporated. During the 15-year tax credit compliance period, the project will be owned by SVDP Management and a to-be-determined tax credit limited partner. Service providers include St. Vincent de Paul Village and the County of San Diego Behavioral Health Services. Property management will be provided by Hyder & Company. The project will provide on-site and off-site services to the 82 tenants. Services include case management, life skills classes, social and community building activities, nursing support, and transportation from the project site to St. Vincent de Paul's Village's downtown campus, where tenants can access all services at the downtown campus. The total development cost of the project will be approximately $24.7 million, which comes to approximately $297,000 per unit, and will be financed with a combination of 9% tax credits, a general partner note, a loan from the County of San Diego's SNH program, and a deferred developer fee. Under the proposed financing, restricted incomes will be 30% of area median income, as seen in Table 6 of the report and on the slide. All tenants, however, are receiving rental assistance through the award of federal project-based Section 8 vouchers and will pay no more than 30% of their income towards rent. Approval of the requested actions would assist in the creation of 82 permanent supportive housing units for chronically homeless persons and homeless with a disability. If approved by the Housing Commission, it is anticipated that the developer will be applying for tax credits in the March round, closing financing in June, and completing rehabilitation in January 2020. I would also like to point out that they would be able to start work in June of 2019. This concludes our presentation, and the developer is also here to answer questions if there are any.
Thank you. I do have a speaker slip for Mr. Bill Bolstad, but it's unclear if he would like to speak or if only available for questions. Got it. Okay, great. Thank you. This is another one that I just want to say I'm very pleased about. The opportunity to find these sorts of locations to convert into permanent supportive housing is wonderful and takes a number of the possible hindrances out of the way. So congratulations to the team and to staff for getting us here. Thank you very much. Are there any other questions?
I spoke well of Wakeland. I need to speak well of Chelsea, too. There's nobody better. We have a long relationship with them as well, and having Father Joe's in the mix is nice, too. So this is another first-class team that staff heartily recommends to you all.
Compliments flying. Do we have a motion? Thank you, Commissioner Davis. And seconded by Commissioner Hubbard. Any further discussion? Okay. All in favor? Motion carries. Thank you very much. And item 107, loan recommendation for Trinity Apartments. Will this also be you, Colin?
It will.
Great.
I want to make sure my seat was comfortable, so. Sorry, I'm waiting for the PowerPoint. Okay. Thank you all for your time. This item is a request that the San Diego Housing Commission approve a residual receipt loan of up to $700,000 for Wakeland Trinity Place LP for the construction of units for homeless seniors that will remain affordable for 55 years. In addition, staff request approval for the Housing Commission President and CEO or designee to adjust financing as necessary, provided that the proposed $700,000 maximum loan amount not increase. Also to substitute approved funding sources and take actions necessary upon the advice of Housing Commission General Counsel to implement the approvals. This proposal supports the Housing First San Diego, which is the Housing Commission's Homelessness Action Plan. It is a proposal to build 74 new permanent supportive housing units. The proposed project will provide 73 affordable living units, approximately 380 square feet each, for homeless seniors and adults with mental disabilities, and one one-bedroom manager unit. The 73 affordable units will remain affordable for 55 years. This development has received an award of 73 federal project-based Section 8 rental assistance vouchers, along with a recommendation for loan funding as part of the Housing First San Diego model. The project is currently occupied by the Good Guys Auto Sales, located at 4445 Glacier Avenue, on the map here, in the Navajo Community Plan area of Council District 7. Included in this presentation are several renderings by the architect, Studio E Architects. The developer of the project will be Wakeland Housing and Community Development Corporation. During the 15-year tax credit compliance period, the project will be owned by Wakeland Housing and a to-be-determined tax credit limited partner. Service providers include St. Paul's Senior Services, St. Paul's PACE, and PATH. The project will incorporate an on-site alternative care clinic managed and operated by St. Paul's PACE. Additional services include, but are not limited to, transportation assistance, case management, medical-related case management, in-home services, health and wellness services, as well as skill building classes. The total development cost for the project will be approximately $30.5 million, which is approximately $413,000 per unit, and will be financed with a combination of 9% tax credits, a permanent loan, a loan from the County of San Diego's SNHP program, and a Civic San Diego loan. Under the proposed financing, restricted incomes will be 30% of area median income, as seen on the slide and Table 6 of the staff report. All tenants will receive rental assistance through the award of the federal project-based Section 8 vouchers. Approval of the requested actions would assist in the creation of 73 permanent supportive housing units for homeless seniors and adults with mental disabilities. If approved by the Housing Commission, it is anticipated that the developer will be applying for tax credits in March, with an award in June, closing financing in December, and completing construction in May of 2021. This concludes our presentation, and the developer is here to answer any questions if there are any.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions from the commissioners? No. I just wanted to point out, as we continue to chip away at the issues with our housing stock and some of those deficits, that today we approved just for senior population alone, something like 120-some units. So, you know, kudos to the staff for really making these things happen. Thank you to the developers who work so diligently to get us to this point. We hope that we can be good partners moving forward. But with that, are there any other questions of the developer or staff? Okay, do we have a motion? Moved by Commissioner Hester. I think you got it. Seconded by Commissioner Davis. I'm freezing. Any further discussion? Okay. All in favor? Aye. Motion carries. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Colin. Does this end your streak? All right. Woo. And with that, item 108, we have two workshops left. All right, so this is marathon length. I'm sorry.
All right. Good morning, Chair Benvenuto, commissioners, Mr. Gentry, Mr. Christensen. My name is Duquette Thal. I'm the Senior Vice President of Business Administration with Deborah Fischel Falk, our Vice President of Procurement and Compliance. Now, typically the items that we present to you revolve around our three core businesses, real estate, rental assistance, and homelessness. So we're going to switch it up a little bit and talk about one of our support teams, the Procurement and Compliance team. The team is led by Deborah Fischel Falk. Deborah's expertise spans 7 years with the agency and 18-plus years with the city prior to us. Marcel Gresham, he is our Director of Procurement. Julia Sauer is our Director of Grants and Compliance. And Sharon Chambers-Feaster is the Program Manager for Section 3 EOC and Labor Compliance. Our team has a variety of internal and external stakeholders. We work collaboratively to assist the various commission departments in achieving their operational and programmatic objectives while striving to excel at our agency's mission. I want to point out before we start the significance of federal, state, and city regulations on our projects. And as we go through the presentations, the division leads will point that out as well. With that, it's Deborah.
Thank you, Kat, and good morning. Procurement and compliance is a multifaceted team that includes three separate but related units. Procurement, Section 3, Equal Opportunity Contracting and Labor Compliance, and Grants and Compliance. While each group has its unique responsibilities, they interrelate and complement each other, as oftentimes they touch the same projects and programs. We procure goods, services, and supplies, administer and monitor federal, state, and local regulatory programs, administer the Affordable Housing Fund, and collaboratively identify, research, and apply for grants on behalf of the Commission. The team has a positive impact through our success in obtaining grants, by providing business opportunities to the local community, ensuring state and or Davis-Bacon wages are paid as required, and through our cost avoidance cost-saving efforts on our procurements. Procurement is led by Marcel Gresham. The team has a variety of duties associated with ensuring the Commission has what it needs, both from an internal operations perspective, as well as goods, services, and supplies to support the numerous programs and development projects. Specific duties are shown on this slide. Now Marcel will share his team highlights.
Good morning, Commissioners, Mr. Christensen, Mr. Gentry. The Commission's procurement function is centralized to ensure consistency in its practices and alignment with regulatory guidelines. We ensure a system of quality and integrity and provide for fair and equitable treatment of all persons and or firms that are involved in the Commission's procurement opportunities. The regulatory guidelines and applicability associated with the Commission's procurement process are shown here. The team follows federal, state, and local guidelines to ensure that we promote administrative flexibility and efficiency, while at the same time, we maintain prudent internal controls and compliance with applicable state statutes and regulations. As the operational needs and requirements of the Commission have changed and in many cases increased over the years, procurement has supported the Commission's objectives through policy adjustments, process improvements, and also strategic planning. In the fiscal year 2018, this strong 8-member team processed more than 10,600 purchase orders and awarded 191 contracts, including 99 new contracts, 71 renewals, and 21 contract amendments. Tying the contract awards to our economic impact, the Commission infused more than $48 million into our local economy. We saved or avoided more than $2.5 million, which amounts to approximately 6% of the total contracts that were awarded. And to ensure that the Commission has a strong competitive base with diverse businesses, we host and participate outreach events to engage potential bidders and proposers. In addition, we provide needed technical assistance to ensure that they are aware of and understand bidding and contracting requirements. This slide shows the outreach and technical assistance for both the procurement department and the Section 3 Equal Opportunity Contracting and Labor Compliance Program teams. During fiscal year 2018, we engaged in 17 outreach events and conducted 62 one-on-one and or group technical assistance sessions. That concludes my portion of this presentation. I will now return it to Deborah. Thank you for your attention.
The 5-member Section 3 Equal Opportunity Contracting and Labor Compliance Unit is led by Sharon Chambers Feaster. This team administers and monitors three specific programs associated with the federal, state, and local funding sources the Commission receives and utilizes on its programs and projects. This includes prevailing wages and business and employment opportunities for low-income residences and business owners. Sharon will now share her team highlights.
Good morning. Thank you. Good morning.
The Section 3 program is a federal program designed to ensure training, employment, and contracting opportunities generated by certain HUD financial assistance are, to the greatest extent feasible, directed toward low-income persons referred to as Section 3 residents, and businesses that employ low-income persons referred to as Section 3 business concerns. The Section 3 program was revamped in 2014 to address programmatic shortfalls, and in 2016, we reviewed our processes and procedures to identify potential efficiencies. The review resulted in a significant reduction in the required paperwork for commission staff and vendors while maintaining the integrity of the program. During fiscal year 2018, we exceeded the HUD Section 3 numerical goals for total dollar amount of contract awards to Section 3 business concerns for both construction and non-construction contracts. For Section 3 covered construction contracts, the goal is 10%. We realized 43%. And for non-construction, the goal is 3%. We realized 23%. The Section 3 program also exceeded the 30% HUD Section 3 numerical goal for Section 3 residents hired as new employees. We achieved 52% of Section 3 residents being hired as new employees on our Section 3 covered contracts. The next program is Equal Opportunity Contracting, referred to as EOC, which was implemented to facilitate the Commission's commitment to awarding contracts to diverse businesses. The EOC program has done an excellent job in facilitating the awarding of prime contracts to diverse businesses. In fiscal year 2018, 23% of prime contracts awarded by the Commission were awarded to diverse businesses. Diverse businesses is comprised of firms that have certified as being small local, small disadvantaged, minority, women, and disabled veteran-owned businesses. The final program in this unit is labor compliance. This team monitors contractors' compliance with state and federal wage laws. Prevailing wages are the basic hourly rates being paid to a majority of workers engaged in a particular craft, classification, or type of work within the locality and in the nearest labor market area. There are two types of wage determinations that are based on the funding source: state prevailing wages, issued by the California Department of Industrial Relations, referred to as DIR, and federal prevailing wages, which refers to the federal Davis-Bacon and related acts, issued by the U.S. Department of Labor. In general, state prevailing wages are higher than federal prevailing wages. During fiscal year 2018, the team monitored 87 construction projects that were subject to prevailing wage requirements. We conducted site visits during which we observed the work being performed and interviewed employees to ensure that contractors were paying their employees the correct wages and employees were aware of the prevailing wage requirements. We are pleased to report that through our diligent review of certified payroll records and conducting site visits, we identified underpayments to employees and facilitated the restitution of over $31,000 to employees. This concludes my presentation. I will turn the microphone back over to Deborah Fischel-Falk. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon. The Grants and Compliance Team, led by Julia Sauer, is most often identified with the Commission's grant activity. However, the team does more. They are also responsible for compliance monitoring and quality assurance related to specific subrecipient grant awards and provide key administrative functions related to the Commission's Affordable Housing Fund, Fair Housing, the Reinvestment Task Force, and certain aspects of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Julia will share highlights of her team.
Good morning. The 10-member Grants and Compliance Team serves as the Commission's centralized Grants Management Group, collaborating with the various departments to identify and apply for grants. We also provide compliance monitoring for grant-funded programs with a heavy emphasis on homeless initiatives, as well as lead the administrative functions of the programs that Deborah mentioned in the previous slide. Federal, state, and local regulations and ordinances provide us guidance regarding our compliance and administrative lead activities. This year, the team's compliance activities included conducting 41 site visits and 51 desk reviews to monitor homeless programs and initiatives, the use of home and capital funds and associated matching funds, and other programs such as the first-time homebuyer and grant-funded workforce and economic development projects. Our team collaborated with other commission departments to monitor follow-up on the agency's facilities implementation plan related to ADA and Section 504 compliance. The team continued to participate as a collaborative partner with the City of San Diego and the San Diego Regional Alliance for Fair Housing and Fair Housing Efforts, including sponsoring an annual fair housing conference. Additionally, we continue to monitor the implementation of the Commission's Language Access Plan and to review affirmative fair housing marketing plans. This year, the team took on new responsibilities, including the administration of the $62 million Affordable Housing Fund and the Commission's role and responsibilities associated with the Reinvestment Task Force. The Reinvestment Task Force is a collaboration of local governments, financial institutions, and nonprofits with the mission of facilitating investment in low and moderate income neighborhoods by monitoring lending policies and practices and developing strategies to increase this investment. In collaboration with many departments, the economic impact of this team was the success in securing nearly $10.5 million in competitive grant awards during fiscal year 2018. These awards include new HUD Continuum of Care and PetSmart Charities funding to support homeless services, U.S. Bank Foundation funds to support the work of the Reinvestment Task Force, and State Farm Foundation funds to support the work of the Achievement Academy to provide financial literacy services to homeless or recently homeless persons. The team facilitated the receipt of over $8 million in city pass-through grant awards, which include Emergency Solutions Grant, Community Development Block Grant, and Home Funds. A newer effort to secure grant funds for SDHC Nonprofit Affiliate Housing Development Partners, or HDP, continued in fiscal year 2018. We worked closely with HDP to secure over $10,000 in awards, including an award from the U.S. Bank Foundation to fund a computer room at Town and Country, an affordable housing site for families, and an award from the County Employees Charitable Organization for Refrigerators at the Mason, an affordable housing site for persons homeless or at risk of homelessness. Securing grant funds from new sources, including private funds, is an important part of SDHC's strategic plan to expand and diversify funding in order to meet our mission. Our 2016-2020 strategic plan goal is to secure $1 million in new funds. To date, we have successfully secured over $2.6 million from 15 new sources, including the Wells Fargo Foundation, the Water Conservation Garden, and Capital Impact Partners. Thank you, and I will turn the presentation to Deborah.
Thank you, Julia. Now, an ongoing goal of the team is to identify and implement process improvements and efficiencies. During fiscal year 2018, we implemented a number of them. After receiving feedback regarding the cumbersome paperwork process related to the Section 3 program, Sharon thoroughly reviewed and implemented a streamlined process without compromising the intent or requirements of the program, which resulted in a 65% reduction in the paperwork contractors were required to submit. The procurement team spearheaded four separate process improvements. Three replaced manual processes with electronic ones, and the Microsoft Office Group process consolidated the back and forth email exchanges to a more collaborative communications format. The Microsoft Office Group process received an award from the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials. Implementing DocuSign, a software system for electronic signatures, removed the manual process of mailing and or, believe it or not, hand-delivering contract documents for signature. And you can imagine things getting lost. It also includes automatic notifications if documents aren't processed that serve as reminders to signers, as well as a follow-up tool for procurement. All of these improvements resulted in significant time and cost savings, as well as very positive responses from our stakeholders. We take pride in our work, and we understand as one of the support team members of the projects and programs of the Commission, it is important that on an ongoing basis, we identify efficiencies and process improvements without compromising the integrity of our regulatory requirements. Another important goal of the team is to continuously pursue excellence, and we have been fortunate enough to be recognized for our efforts both locally and nationally, as seen on this slide. For the Excellence in Procurement Award this year, our submission for one of the elements, which is demonstrating continuous improvement, was designated as a model response and is included as a guide for this year's application process. This is particularly noteworthy as this is only the second year we've applied for and received the honor. Thank you for this opportunity to present, and we are available for any questions you may have.
Thank you, and congratulations. Do we have any questions from commissioners? Some comments? Go for it.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Excellent job.
Ditto.
Tim, I'm not quite that eloquent. It's going to take me a little longer. There's an old joke that what the golden rule really means is that he who has the goal makes the rule. And we have a lot of rules attached to the funding that comes in to operate this place. And if all we do is compliance with those rules, then we turn into another plotting bureaucracy. If we don't pay attention to the rules, so and just look at product development, pretty soon y'all will have another CEO running the joint here. So what we need to do is to look at a good balance between procurement and product, process, and accomplishments. And I'll say honestly that what Deborah and her team have done here is a wonderful job of making sure that we dot I's, we cross the T's, and that we not put funding in jeopardy or this agency in jeopardy. And they've done that working in collaboration with our program people to make sure that we still provide quality products too. And Deborah, you have my thanks for that. It's not at all what it was here 10 years ago. Thank you very much for that. That is Deborah and her shop, along with her attorney, that keeps me out of trouble at least part of the time. Thank you.
And hoping to continue on with the good news, we have a presentation from Jeff and Suquette on the Moving to Work annual plan. Hello, gentlemen.
Good morning, Jeff Davis, Chief of Staff, and with me is Suquette Dayal, Senior Vice President of Business Administration. This morning we are presenting to you the Housing Commission's Fiscal Year 2020 Moving to Work Annual Plan. Should I be waiting? I'll begin with an overview of the Moving to Work, or MTW, program. Then Suquette will share with you the MTW initiatives we are proposing this year, and we'll take any questions or comments that you may have. The Housing Commission's MTW status allows flexibility to implement a variety of innovative, cost-effective approaches to providing housing assistance in the City of San Diego. The Housing Commission is one of only 39 public housing authorities out of 3,400 nationwide to receive this MTW designation from HUD. Our CEO, Mr. Gentry, serves on the National MTW Steering Committee, which includes all MTW agencies. And just a note, in 2015, Congress directed HUD to expand the MTW program by 100 public housing agencies nationwide over a seven-year period. So each year we present the Housing Commission's proposed MTW annual plan to this board as an informational workshop to receive your feedback. And then next month we will bring to the board an action item with a staff recommendation to approve the plan for fiscal year 2020. Should the board approve the plan, we will then submit it to HUD. The Housing Commission's MGW flexibility provides funding toward the creation and preservation of affordable rental housing. For example, the Housing Commission invested $7.1 million toward the rehabilitation of 84 affordable rental units at Villas Las Cumbres in Linda Vista. In addition, as an MGW agency, the Housing Commission can commit rental housing vouchers to address homelessness. And one example of that is the 91 vouchers committed to Quality Inn, which the Housing Commission acquired to create permanent supportive housing units for those experiencing homelessness. And we create opportunities for federal rental assistance participants and our public housing residents to become more financially self-reliant. And we do this with our San Diego Housing Commission Achievement Academy. So Suket will now walk you through the initiatives that we will propose for our 2020 plan.
As Jeff mentioned, this year we have two initiatives for the FY 2020 plan. The first is our Landlord Partnership Program, which is a new initiative. And the second is our Monarch School Project, which is a reproposal of a 2016 initiative. So the Landlord Partnership Program was developed to in response to one of the needs that we have in our city. Our city continues to face a tough rental market. We have low vacancy rates coupled with high market rents. This program aims to expand opportunities for our families and our landlords by providing incentives to landlords to increase their participation. The program was inspired by the success of our Landlord Engagement and Assistance Program, the LEAP program, part of our Homeless Action Plan. We also developed this program by engaging with our Landlord Advisory Committee and sought their feedback on the incentives. Listed on the slide are some of the incentives that we're proposing. The first is a one-time incentive payment. Now, this is going to be $500 awarded to all new leases that are signed. The second is access to Landlord Partnership and Assurance Fund. So what happens in some cases, we do have tenants that may cause wear and tear damage that goes above and beyond the security deposits. Landlords will have access to these funds. The third is a move flexibility allowance, and this was developed in good partnership with the landlords. We realized that during the process of a move, there are some dates where there is an overlap. So I'm moving out of unit A, moving to unit B, but I might be 2 days in both units. And that's a loss for the landlords. So what this does is this mitigates that loss for the landlords and ensures the landlord is not harmed. We're also simplifying the inspection process. Two components to this. The first one is we're going to go ahead and provide a 60-day inspection. So we can go ahead, inspect a unit, and if it's approved, it's good for 60 days. It's valid for 60 days. And the second is we have a quality insurance inspection that we do on our inspection processes. We will count those quality insurances as a successful biennial inspection. The last two points I think are the most important. It's the landlord liaison team. Now, this is going to be a dedicated team that's going to work with our landlords and our families. For the landlords, it'll work with the landlords to identify units that we probably do not have right now, or units that are coming up on the market that we can prep them for our families. For our teams, for our families, this team assists them with filling out forms, working with the landlords. This team is the perfect bridge between the landlords and the participants, and that bridge is what is part of a lot of success that we've seen in the LEAP program. We hope to emulate that success with this program. This initiative meets the Moving to Work statutory objective of increasing housing choices for our families, and we hope the results show a decrease in the lease times for our families. The next initiative is a reproposal, and this is our Monarch School Project. So back in 2016, we proposed a local non-traditional rental assistance program in partnership with the Monarch School. The Monarch School's mission is to educate students impacted by homelessness and provide them with skills for a bright future. As part of the pilot program, we provided rental assistance for up to 25 families. Now, these families engaged with our Achievement Academy and as they move towards economic independence. The idea was to create a holistic approach for our families. So you have the kids that are working with the Monarch School, the parents that are working with the Achievement Academy, and all along they have housing stability covered through the program. The program worked well for some families, but we found that homelessness is not a one-size-fits-all. And that's where the reproposal comes in. With the reproposal, we want to modify the program to ensure that our families have access to the appropriate intervention, including permanent supportive housing, if needed. Now, the Achievement Academy will continue to work with all work-able individuals in the household. Our homeless team will continue to provide light case management for the families. And through the LEAP program, families will still be able to access units and ensure successful lease-ups. What will be different is if a family does need a permanent supportive housing level of services, then we will be able to provide those services. By providing the right intervention at the right time, as needed by the family, we want to ensure success for our families. That concludes our presentation, and we're open for questions.
Thanks so much. We're losing people protesting probably the length of how I run a meeting. So, but this was very helpful. I want to say real fast that the Section 8 item, I'm particularly pleased to see. I know with the city kind of changing some of their regulation, there's a little bit of heartburn from our landlord population. Of course, not all. But whatever helps to ease that is going to make it easier for many other landlords to follow suit. And being the model leaders that staff always is when we're responding to policy, I'm very confident this will go well. So thank you for bringing that forward. Additionally, I did have one quick question. I've brought this up a couple of times. I know I'm probably being obnoxious at this point. The preservation component of the how the moving to work dollars could be used, I know there was some requests from council earlier last year about what we're doing on the preservation side, how we're keeping track of those units. I just wanted to highlight what's going on there.
You set me up very nicely, Madam Chair. We actually brought a new staff person on board Monday this week who's...
That's fantastic.
Who is charged with preservation focus. That person sits in a real estate shop. But because we are an integrated organization functionally, they will relate to our voucher program as well. And so bottom line, we're going to make it work. And what that person is going to be doing is identifying as much as we can subsidized properties that are at risk of losing their subsidy over the next 10 years. And so that allows us to know where they are so that we look to mitigation strategies so that we won't have another Rancho Panisquitas issue popping up. Or if there is one, we'll see it coming and we'll deal with it ahead of time. And also, insofar as the records allow, we're going to go backwards and look to see exactly what we indeed have lost as a community going back. And I think we should be able to do a pretty good job of identifying those that have lost federal contracts and other subsidized efforts. The one that's going to be may be impossible is identifying what has been lost through market changes, gentrification, and loss of naturally occurring affordable housing because of market appreciation. But we're going to develop the data as best we can. But that's underway.
Thank you very much.
And could I have one more comment as well, too, please? The Moving to Work program has transformed this agency over the last 10 years more than anything else we've done. And the two issues we're dealing with now may sound like relatively small potatoes or appendages to the program. That's because of the major transformation that's already happened. None of you all were around when this got started back in 2009. We actually got reinstated back into this program in January of 2009 after my arrival in September of 2008. And we've used Moving to Work to transform the organization better than any of the other 39 have done. And I say that objectively. So at some point, we'd love to show you what we've done in the past in terms of path to success. Have we made productive engagement, make sense for our customers rather than harming them, trying to get every dollar they make back to us as rent? That's changed remarkably from what it used to be. All the way toward efficiencies we put in place, to the monies that we've generated in return retained savings that we've used to invest in other properties. Nobody else in the country has done this combination of changes to the program like we've done. And so what you heard today was just icing on the cake. If you're interested in a more detailed survey of what we've done, we'd be glad to set that up for you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions, comments? Okay. Thank you both, and looking forward to the report next month. I think that brings us to the end, and we'll now move into closed session.
Yeah, thank you. For the record, the Housing Commission will now convene in closed session on the matter set forth both in its regular agenda, which is a conference with legal counsel concerning the lawsuit of SDHC versus APR, and the matter on the special agenda concerning the potential initiation of litigation.